Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a topic that's really fundamental to financial security. But, you know, it often feels more complicated than maybe it needs to be. Life insurance.
Right. It can seem daunting.
Exactly. We've got this detailed document, lifeinsuranceandethics.pdf. And, well, our mission here is to pull out the really essential stuff, the key knowledge, and maybe some surprising insights for you. The goal is to give you a clear understanding without you having to wade through, you know, all the jargon yourself. Think of it as your fast track.
Yeah, a way to get informed about what it does, how it works, and importantly, why it might matter to you. This document, it really covers the whole spectrum, from the history to some pretty complex ethical points.
So we're boiling it down for you.
That's the plan, give you that core understanding you need.
Okay, so let's kick things off right at the beginning. It seems like the idea of life insurance, it actually has pretty deep roots, right? It goes way back.
It really does. I mean, formal insurance, that started more with property. Think after the Great Fire of London in 1666. But that desire to protect loved ones financially after someone dies, that eventually led to what we now call life insurance.
Right.
The first sort of modern company was the Amicable Society for a Perpetual Assurance Office. That's in England, way back in 1706.
1706.
Yeah. And what's interesting is they charged everyone the same annual fee. Didn't matter about your health or age, really.
A flat fee for life insurance. That sounds risky, like a gamble.
It kind of was. And that's where Edmund Halley comes into the picture.
Halley, like the comic guy.
That's the one, yeah. Back in 1693, he developed the first proper mortality tables. He used data from a city in Poland, Breslau.
Huh.
And this was a huge deal. It meant for the first time premiums could be calculated systematically based on, you know, life expectancy. It's really the foundation of how it's all priced today.
So that brought some math into it, not just a flat guess. How did it make its way over to America?
Well, the very first American company popped up in 1759. It was started by the Presbyterian synods in Philadelphia. Mostly for ministers and their families.
So kind of community-based initially.
Exactly. Very much so. But then things started getting more commercial in the 1840s. You saw companies like New York Life, Massachusetts Mutual forming, and they brought in more sophisticated underwriting.
Underwriting.
Right.
That's figuring out the risk of insuring someone, right?
Precisely. Yeah. Looking at things like your health, your job, your lifestyle, it allowed for, you know, more tailored pricing.
Okay.
Then later in the 19th century, you got something called industrial life insurance. Think Metropolitan Life, Prudential, smaller policies designed for working class families.
And how did that work?
Agents actually collected the premiums weekly, in person, often door to door, made it accessible.
Wow, door to door. A world away from clicking buy now online.
Absolutely. And then the 20th century brought another big shift. Group life insurance. Started in 1911, actually, for employees at a leather company.
Just one company.
Initially, yeah. But by the 1950s, it had become a pretty standard employee benefit. It really changed how a lot of Americans get their coverage.
Okay, that's a great historical overview. Really sets the stage. Now let's get into some of the nuts and bolts. Premiums, that's what you pay, right? But it's not always the same kind of payment.
Definitely not. There are different ways premiums can work. You might have level premiums. They stay the same for the life of the policy or the term.
Okay, predictable.
Or you could have increasing premiums. Typically, they go up over time, like with some term policies. Then there's flexible premiums, common in universal life, where you have some leeway in timing and amount.
Gives you some control.
Right. And finally, limited payment premiums. You pay for a set number of years, maybe 10 or 20, or until age 65, but the coverage lasts for your whole life.
So you pay it off faster, essentially.
Kind of, yeah. Higher payments for a shorter time. How you pay definitely impacts your budget and the total cost over time.
Gotcha. And then the core of it all, the death benefit. That's the payout, right?
Exactly. That's the money paid out when the insured person passes away. But even that isn't always just one fixed amount.
Oh. How can that vary?
Well, it can be level, just a set amount. Or it might increase over time, maybe through dividends in a whole life policy or interest crediting. Sometimes it can even decrease.
Decrease? Why would you want that?
Think mortgage protection insurance. The death benefit is designed to shrink alongside your mortgage balance.
Okay. Makes sense.
And a really important feature now is accelerated death benefits. Many policies let you access part of the death benefit early if you get diagnosed with a terminal illness or need long-term care.
So you can use the benefit while you're still living in certain situations.
Precisely. It adds a layer of flexibility for critical needs.
Now, permanent policies, they have this thing called cash value. This can be a bit confusing for people, I think.
It can be, yeah. But it's a key feature. The way it works varies quite a bit, though, depending on the policy type.
Okay, break it down for us.
So, in traditional whole life, the cash value growth is guaranteed. It increases predictably over time according to a schedule.
Safe and steady.
Right. With universal life, it usually earns interest based on a rate declared by the insurance company, which can change, you know, based on market conditions.
More variable then.
A bit, yeah. Then you have variable life, where the cash value is actually linked to the performance of investment subaccounts you choose, kind of like mutual funds within the policy.
So market risk involved there.
Definitely. Potential for higher growth, but also potential for loss. And then there's indexed universal life, or IUL. Its growth is tied to a market index, like the S&P 500, but you're not directly invested.
Hmm. Interesting hybrid. And you can get this cash value out.
Yes, there are ways to access it. Withdrawals, policy loans, or surrendering the policy entirely. But, and this is crucial, you need to understand the tax implications. They're different for each method.
Right. Taxes always matter. Okay, underwriting. We mentioned it briefly. It sounds like a really critical step in getting a policy.
It absolutely is. Underwriting is the process the insurance company uses to assess the risk of insuring you. How likely are you to, well, pass away sooner rather than later?
A bit morbid, but necessary for them, I guess.
It is. They look at a whole range of factors. Your age, gender, your health history, family medical history, your occupation, hobbies, lifestyle choices. Smoking's a big one, obviously.
Okay.
Based on all that, they assign you a risk classification. It could range from, say, preferred plus for the super healthy, down through standard, maybe even to substandard for higher risks.
And that classification directly impacts the price.
Hugely. The difference in premiums between preferred plus and just standard can easily be over 50%, sometimes much more.
Wow. So staying healthy can literally save you a lot of money on life insurance.
It really can.
What about the fine print, the specific rules within the policy? Policy provisions and features.
Yeah, those are important. They define how the contract works. For example, there's usually a contestability period.
What's up?
It's typically the first 1 or 2 years the policy is in force. During this time, the insurance company can investigate and potentially deny a claim if they find there was a serious misrepresentation on your application, like hiding a major health condition.
Okay, so honesty is key on the application.
Absolutely critical. There's also usually a suicide clause. This typically states that if the insured dies by suicide within the first year or two, the company will usually just refund the premiums paid, not the full death benefit.
Right. And what about missing a payment?
That's where the grace period comes in. It gives you some extra time, usually about 30 or 31 days after the premium due date, to make the payment without the policy lapsing or canceling.
Good safety net to have. And you mentioned riders earlier, ways to customize a policy.
Exactly. Riders are optional add-ons that let you tailor the coverage. Very common ones include a waiver of premium rider.
How does that work?
If you become totally disabled and can't work, this rider can pause your premium payments but keep your coverage active. It's a really valuable protection.
Definitely sounds like it. What else?
There's often a guaranteed insurability rider, or GIO. This lets you buy additional coverage at specific future dates or life events, like marriage or having a child, without needing another medical exam.
Oh, that's useful, especially if your health changes.
Very useful. We already talked about accelerated death benefit riders.
Yeah.
And you can often add child riders, which provide a small amount of term coverage on your children.
Okay. Lots of ways to tweak it. Finally, on terms, any key regulatory concepts we should know? Things designed to protect consumers.
Yes, a few important ones. The free look period is a big one.
Free look.
Yeah. After you receive your policy documents, you typically have a set period, maybe 10, 20, or even 30 days, depending on the state, to review it thoroughly. If you decide it's not right for you, you can return it for a full refund of any premiums paid. No questions asked.
That's good consumer protection.
It is. Then there are replacement regulations. If you're thinking about switching from one life insurance policy to another, there are specific rules agents and companies have to follow.
Why is that needed?
To make sure you get full disclosure about the potential pros and cons. Replacing a policy isn't always a good idea, so these rules aim to protect you from making a poor decision based on incomplete information.
Gotcha.
And finally, the concept of insurable interest. This just means that the person buying the policy owner, must have a legitimate financial reason for doing so. Usually it means they'd suffer financially if the insured person died. You can't just, you know, take out a policy on a random stranger.
Right. Prevents gambling on lives, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a really solid grounding in the key terms. Now, the document we looked at points out something pretty interesting. This gap between who owns life insurance and who maybe needs it. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's quite striking, actually. The data shows that only about 52% of American adults currently have any life insurance.
Only about half.
Right. And that number is down significantly from maybe 30 years ago when it was closer to 70%.
Huh. So ownership is declining.
But here's the paradox. At the same time, studies show that a large percentage of households, maybe around 44%, say they would face serious financial hardship within just 6 months if a primary wage earner died.
Wow. So the need seems high, maybe even increasing, but the coverage is lower. That is a disconnect. Who's most likely to be in that gap?
It seems to be particularly pronounced among younger adults, millennials, Gen Z. They tend to have the lowest ownership rates.
Even though they might be starting families, taking on mortgages, student debt.
Exactly. Times when the financial impact of losing an income could be devastating. There are likely a few reasons behind this.
Like what?
Well, competing financial priorities are definitely one. Rent, student loans, saving for a down payment. Life insurance might feel like something they can put off.
Okay, that makes sense.
There's also a huge misconception about cost. People consistently overestimate how much life insurance actually costs, sometimes by 300%, even 500% or more. Especially younger, healthier people.
Really? By that much?
Yeah. They think it's way more expensive than it often is, especially for term insurance. And thirdly, the ways people buy insurance are just changing.
How so? How has distribution shifted?
We're seeing a much bigger mix now. Traditional agents and brokers are still very important, of course. But direct-to-consumer channels, especially online platforms, are growing rapidly.
Buying online, like everything else.
Pretty much, especially for simpler products like term life. Estimates suggest around 30% of new term policies are now bought through these digital channels.
Okay. What about the workplace?
That's still a major source. Many employers offer group life insurance, often some basic coverage for free, and then options to buy additional voluntary coverage conveniently through payroll deduction.
So more ways to buy, but ownership is still down.
Interesting. What about the types of policies people are actually buying these days? Any trends there?
Term insurance is definitely dominant. It makes up something like 70% of all new individual policies sold.
What do you think that is? Well, it's generally simpler to understand, and it's often significantly more affordable than permanent insurance, especially when you're younger. It allows people to get a larger amount of coverage for a specific period when their needs are typically highest, like when kids are young or the mortgage is large.
Makes sense. Get the most protection bang for your buck when you need it most.
Exactly. And we're also seeing term policies evolve. More of them are offering options like return of premium or ROP and those living benefit riders we talked about earlier for critical or chronic illness. They're becoming more flexible.
Okay. And it sounds like regulations are trying to keep up with all this too.
They are. There's a growing regulatory focus on product suitability, making sure the policy recommended is actually appropriate for the person buying it. Mm. This is especially true for more complex products like, say, index universal life. And we're also seeing a movement towards implementing what are called best interest standards in many areas. This essentially requires financial professionals, including insurance agents in some contexts, to put their clients' financial interests ahead of their own.
That sounds like a positive direction. Okay, let's dive deeper into the specific types of policies. We've mentioned term and permanent. Let's really break down term insurance first. What are the main varieties you might encounter?
Sure. So term insurance gives you coverage for a specific period, the term, right? Like 10, 20, or 30 years. The simplest form is probably annual renewable term, or ART.
Annual renewable. How does that work?
With ART, your premium starts low, but it increases every year as you get older. The death benefit usually stays level. It can be very cheap initially, but those rising premiums can become really expensive later on, so it's often best for very short-term needs.
Okay, maybe not ideal for long-term planning then. What about decreasing term? You mentioned that for mortgages?
Exactly. Decreasing term policies typically have a level premium. It stays the same, but the death benefit gradually goes down over the term. It's designed to mirror a decreasing debt, most commonly a mortgage. As you pay down your loan, the coverage amount reduces too.
Purpose built. Makes sense. Now, return of premium term, ROP. That sounds intriguing. You get your money back.
That's the pitch, yeah. With an ROP policy, if you outlive the term, the insurance company promises to refund some or all of the premiums you paid.
Why would they do that?
It appeals to people who dislike the use it or lose it nature of traditional term insurance. They feel like they're getting something back, even if they don't die.
But there's a catch, I assume.
The catch is cost. ROQ policies are significantly more expensive than standard term policies, often 30% to 50% more, sometimes even higher. You're paying a lot extra for that potential premium return.
So you have to weigh whether that extra cost is worth it for you.
Definitely. And we're seeing more and more term policies, even standard ones, include those living benefits riders now.
Right, the accelerated benefits for illness.
Exactly. Riders that let you access part of the death benefit if you're diagnosed with a terminal, chronic, or critical illness. These are becoming almost standard features, often included at little or no extra upfront premium cost. Using them reduces the final death benefit, of course.
Adds a lot of value beyond just the death benefit. Okay, let's switch gears to whole life insurance. This is the classic permanent insurance, right? It sounds like there are different kinds within this category, too.
There are. One key difference is between participating, or PAR, policies, and non-participating, or non-PAR, policies.
Okay, what's the difference?
Participating policies are typically issued by mutual insurance companies. Since mutual companies are owned by their policyholders, these policies may pay out dividends.
Dividends. Like stocks.
Sort of, but not quite the same. These dividends represent a share of the company's favorable results if mortality experience, investment returns, and expenses are better than expected. They're not guaranteed, but many established mutual companies have a strong history of paying them.
So it's like getting a partial refund or a share of profits if the company does well.
That's a good way to think about it, since you're essentially a part owner.
And non-participating.
Non-PAR policies are usually issued by stock insurance companies, which are owned by stockholders. These policies don't pay dividends. Instead, they might offer slightly lower initial premiums or perhaps higher guaranteed cash value growth compared to a PAR policy.
So a trade-off between potential dividends and maybe lower initial cost or higher guarantees.
Exactly. The choice affects the policy's long-term cost and growth potential.
And how do you actually pay for whole life? Is it always paying forever?
Not necessarily. The most common way is continuous premium or straight life, where you pay premiums for your entire life, or usually until age of 100 to 121, depending on the policy. This results in the lowest annual premium.
To spread the cost out.
Right. But there are also limited payment options. You might see 10 pay, 20 pay, or pay to 65. Here, you pay premiums for only that specified period, 10 years, 20 years, or until you turn 65, but the policy remains in force for your whole life.
But the annual payments must be higher then.
Yes, significantly higher, because you're compressing all the lifetime premiums into a shorter time frame.
Okay. We talked about cash value earlier. How do you actually get your hands on that money in a whole life policy if you need it?
Several ways. Policy loans are very common. You can borrow against the cash value. It's generally not considered a taxable event as long as the policy stays active.
Do you have to pay it back?
There's usually no required repayment schedule, but interest accrues on the loan. If you don't repay it, the outstanding loan balance plus accrued interest is deducted from the death benefit when you pass away.
Okay. What else?
You can also take partial surrenders or withdrawals. This permanently reduces the policy's death benefit and its future cash value growth. Withdrawals up to your basis, the total premiums you've paid are usually tax-free. Amounts above your basis are typically taxed as ordinary income.
So loans might be more tax-friendly in some cases?
Often. Yes, if managed properly. And finally, you can fully surrender the policy. This cancels the coverage completely, and you receive the net cash surrender value, which is the cash value minus any surrender charges or outstanding loans. Again, there could be tax consequences if the surrender value exceeds your basis.
Lots to consider there. And those dividends from participating policies, what can you do with them?
You usually have several options. You can take them in cash, use them to reduce your future premium payments, leave them with the insurer to accumulate at interest, which itself is usually taxable, or, and this is often recommended for long-term growth, use them to purchase paid-up additions.
Paid-up additions, what are those?
They're like small, fully paid-up, mini whole life policies that increase both your total death benefit and your cash value growth over time. It's a powerful way to compound the policy's value. You can sometimes also use dividends to buy additional term insurance.
Interesting. And just like term, you can add riders to whole life.
Absolutely. Waiver of premium, guaranteed insurability, accelerated death benefits, those common riders, can usually be added to tailor a whole life policy to your specific needs.
Okay, that covers whole life pretty well. Let's move on to Universal Life, or UL. You mentioned transparency is a key feature here.
It is, relatively speaking. With UL policies, you typically get regular statements that break down exactly what's happening inside the policy.
What kind of details?
You'll usually see how much premium you paid, how much was deducted for the cost of insurance, that's the pure death protection charge, what the administrative fees were, how much interest was credited to your cash value, and what the current cash value and surrender value are.
So you can see the moving parts more clearly than in traditional whole life.
Generally, yes. It helps you track the policy's performance over time.
And the death benefit in UL, it's not always just one fixed amount either.
Right.
Correct. UL policies typically offer a choice. Option A, sometimes called the level death benefit option, maintains the specified face amount. As your cash value grows, the actual amount of pure insurance coverage the company needs to provide decreases.
So the cash value makes up part of the death benefit over time.
Essentially, yes. Option B, often called the increasing death benefit option, pays the specified face amount plus the accumulated cash value at death. So the total payout increases as the cash value grows.
And you can choose between these?
Usually, yes. And often you can switch between option A and option B later on, though there might be underwriting requirements to switch to option B. This adds flexibility as your needs change.
You also mentioned the costs in UL are unbundled. What does that mean in practice?
It means the different charges are explicitly broken out. Unlike in traditional whole life, where they're more bundled together, you have the cost of insurance, or COI charges.
What determines that cost?
It's based primarily on your age, health rating, and the net amount at risk, which is the difference between the death benefit and the cash value. The COI charges typically increase each year as you get older.
Okay. What other charges?
There are usually policy administration fees, which can be flat monthly fees, a percentage of your premium, or a charge per $1,000 of death benefit. And often, especially in the early years, there are surrender charges if you withdraw more than a certain amount of cash value or surrender the policy entirely.
So fees to be aware of. What about traditional universal life specifically? What are its main traits?
Traditional UL is designed to offer cash accumulation along with flexibility. It earns interest based on current assumption crediting rates set by the insurer. These rates can fluctuate based on the insurer's investment performance and market conditions.
What kind of rates have they been recently?
Lately, they've often been in the, say, 3% to 5% range. But there's usually a guaranteed minimum interest rate, too, maybe around 1% or 2%. So your cash value won't earn less than that minimum, even if market rates fall sharply.
And the flexibility.
That's key. You usually have flexibility in the timing and amount of your premium payments within certain limits. You can choose your death benefit option, and you can access the cash value via loans or withdrawals.
Sounds good, but are there downsides?
The main vulnerability is to interest rate fluctuations. If interest rates fall significantly and stay low for a long time, the policy might not perform as well as initially illustrated. Your cash value might grow slower, and you might need to pay higher premiums down the road to keep the policy from lapsing or canceling.
So you really need to monitor a UL policy's performance.
Absolutely. You need to understand the illustrations, know the guaranteed elements versus the non-guaranteed projections, and keep an eye on whether the policy is performing as expected. Understand the grace period, minimum premium requirements, and how features like automatic premium loans work if your policy has them.
Okay, good advice. Next up, variable life insurance. This one sounds like it's directly linked to market investments.
That's exactly right. Variable life, and more commonly variable universal life, or VUL, puts you on the driver's seat regarding the cash value investments.
How so?
You choose how to allocate your cash value among a menu of different investment options called subaccounts. These subaccounts function much like mutual funds, investing in various asset classes, stocks, bonds, international, etc.
So you're essentially investing within the insurance policy.
Correct. There's usually also a fixed account option that offers a guaranteed minimum interest rate if you want some stability. But the performance of your cash value overall depends directly on how well the subaccounts you choose perform.
Which means potential for higher returns.
Yes, potentially much higher growth than fixed rate policies if the markets do well. But also, crucially, the risk of loss. If your chosen subaccounts perform poorly, your cash value can decrease.
So definitely not for the risk averse. I imagine the regulation is different too.
You bet. Because it involves securities, variable life is regulated not just by state insurance departments, but also by the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC.
Okay, what does that mean for the consumer?
It means the policy is considered a security, so you'll receive a prospectus detailing the investment objectives, risks, fees, and expenses. The agent selling it must have securities licenses, like a Series 6 or Series 7, in addition to their insurance license. And there are specific suitability standards to ensure the product is appropriate for your risk tolerance and financial goals.
What about the costs? Are variable policies more expensive?
They often have higher internal fees compared to other types of permanent insurance. You'll typically see mortality and expense, M&E, risk charges. These compensate the insurer for guaranteeing certain costs won't exceed limits. There are administrative fees, investment management fees charged by the managers of the subaccounts, and usually surrender charges in the early years.
That sounds like a lot of fees.
It can be. This expense drag means the subaccounts need to generate pretty good returns just to break even and then outperform the fees to provide competitive growth compared to other options.
But it still offers the same core life insurance tax benefits.
Yes, generally. Tax-deferred cash value growth, usually an income tax-free death benefit for beneficiaries, and the ability to take tax-advantaged policy loans. Partial withdrawals up to basis are also typically tax-free.
Are there any special tax rules just for variable life?
Yes. The Modified Endowment Contract, MEC, rules apply, which limit how quickly you can fund the policy to prevent it from being used purely as a tax shelter. There are also specific IRS diversification requirements for the underlying subaccounts, and something called the investor control doctrine limits how much direct control you can have over the specific investment decisions within the subaccounts while still maintaining the tax benefits.
Okay, complex stuff. Now, let's tackle indexed universal life, or IUL. This sounds like it tries to capture the best of both worlds, maybe bridging fixed and variable.
That's a pretty good description. IUL is a type of universal life insurance, so it has that premium and death benefit flexibility. But instead of earning a declared interest rate or being directly invested in the market, its cash value growth is linked to the performance of a market index.
Like the S&P 500.
Exactly. The S&P 500 is very common, but you might also see links to the NASDAQ, Russell 2000, international indices, or even proprietary blended indices. The key point is your money isn't directly invested in the stocks of that index.
So how does the interest crediting actually work then, if you're not invested?
It works through a formula based on the index's performance over a specific period, usually using a few key components: the participation rate, caps, and floors.
Okay, explain those. Participation rate.
The participation rate determines what percentage of the index's positive movement is credited to your policy. For example, if the participation rate is 80% and the index goes up 10%, your policy would be credited based on an 8% gain before considering caps.
And caps.
A cap is a maximum rate of interest your policy can earn regardless of how high the index goes. If the cap is, say, 9% and the index goes up 15% and participation rate allows for more than 9%, you'd still only get credited 9% interest for that period.
So it limits your upside potential. What about the floor?
The floor is the minimum interest rate credited, even if the index goes down. This is typically 0%. So if the index has a negative return for the period, your cash value subject to the index doesn't decrease due to those market losses, though policy charges are still deducted.
Ah, so downside protection. That creates a unique return pattern, right?
Exactly. It's often called an asymmetric return profile. You get to participate in some of the market upside up to the cap, but you're protected from the direct downside market losses by the floor.
Are there different ways the index performance is measured?
Yes. Insurers offer various indexing strategies or crediting methods. Common ones include annual point-to-point, which just looks at the change from the start of the year to the end. Monthly averaging smooths out volatility by averaging the index values over the year. Monthly sum caps look at monthly changes. There are also multi-year strategies. Each has different potential return characteristics and might have different caps or participation rates associated with it.
And you usually get to choose which index or strategy to use.
Typically, yes. Most IUL policies offer several index options and maybe a fixed account option, too. You can often allocate your cash value among different strategies.
How do the insurance companies actually afford to offer this index link with a floor?
Primarily through sophisticated hedging strategies.
Yeah.
They typically invest the bulk of the policyholder premiums in their general account, aiming to earn enough to cover the 0% floor guarantee. Then they use a smaller portion of the investment earnings to buy options, usually call options, on the relevant market index.
Options.
Yeah. If the index goes up, the value of these call options increases, providing the funds needed to pay the indexed interest to the policyholders, up to the cap. If the index goes down, the options might expire worthless, but the principal is protected by the general account investments supporting the floor. The cost of these options directly influences the caps and participation rates the insurer can offer.
Interesting. So that 0% floor is a really key feature.
It's arguably the defining feature of IUL's growth potential. By eliminating the direct impact of market losses on your indexed interest crediting, it prevents negative returns from eroding your cash value beyond policy charges and avoids the damaging effect of compounding losses that you'd experience with direct market investments.
So in flat or down markets, it could potentially outperform direct investments, even if it lags in strong bull markets because of the caps.
That's the potential trade-off, yes. It aims for moderate, more consistent growth over the long term by capturing some upside and avoiding the major dips.
Are there different IUL designs, like focused on different goals?
Yes, definitely. Some IUL policies are designed primarily for cash value accumulation. They might have lower internal charges and potentially higher caps or participation rates to maximize growth potential. Others might be designed more for death benefit protection, perhaps with stronger secondary guarantees to ensure the coverage stays in force, even if cash value growth is modest, and many fall somewhere in between.
Given the complexity with caps, floors, participation rates, indexing strategies, what are the big things consumers need to understand about IUL?
It's crucial to understand that the caps and participation rates are not guaranteed. The insurance company can, and often does, change them over time, usually annually, based on their hedging costs and market conditions.
So the illustrations showing future growth are just projections based on current rates.
Exactly. They're not promises. You need to look at illustrations based on realistic assumptions and understand the potential impact if those non-guaranteed elements become less favorable in the future. Also, be very clear on the internal policy charges and how they impact your net returns. It really requires working with an advisor who understands IUL deeply and can explain it clearly and transparently.
Good advice. Okay, let's shift to some more specialized types. Final expense insurance. Who is that aimed at?
Final expense insurance is specifically targeted towards seniors, typically those aged 50 to 85. It's designed to cover, well, final expenses, things like funeral and burial costs, any outstanding medical bills, small debts, etc.
So smaller policy amounts.
Yes, much smaller face amounts than typical life insurance, usually somewhere between $5,000 and maybe $50,000. They are almost always whole life policies, meaning they build some cash value and the coverage lasts for life as long as premiums are paid.
And the underwriting, is it easier to qualify?
Generally, yes. Underwriting is simplified. Often it just involves answering a few health questions on the application. There's usually no medical exam required. This makes it accessible for seniors who might have some health issues that could make qualifying for larger, fully underwritten policies difficult or expensive.
Because the underwriting is simpler and the target market is older, is it more expensive per dollar of coverage?
Yes. The cost per $1,000 of death benefit is typically higher than for larger policies. This reflects the higher average age and mortality risk of the insured group, the fact that fixed administrative costs are spread over a smaller face amount, and sometimes higher distribution costs.
What are typical premiums like?
The monthly premiums are often designed to be affordable for seniors on fixed incomes, maybe ranging from $30 to $150 per month, depending on age, health, and the coverage amount.
How are these policies usually sold?
You see a lot of direct response marketing TV ads, direct mail, online ads. The messaging often focuses on peace of mind, protecting loved ones from burial costs, and leaving a small legacy. It's an area where suitability is really important, ensuring seniors aren't pressured into buying coverage they don't need or can't truly afford.
Okay. Then there's guaranteed issue life insurance. The name sounds like anyone can get it.
Pretty much, within certain age limits, usually also 50 to 85. Guaranteed issue, or GI, policies have no health questions at all. Approval is virtually guaranteed, regardless of your health history.
That sounds like a last resort option for people with serious health problems.
It often serves that purpose, yes. It provides a safety net for those who can't qualify for any other type of life insurance due to significant health issues.
But there must be trade-offs.
Absolutely. Because the insurer is taking on unknown, potentially very high risks, GI policies have significant limitations. The face amounts available are usually very low, often even lower than final expense policies, maybe maxing out at $25,000 or so. The premiums are typically the highest per $1,000 of coverage.
Okay. Anything else?
Yes. A crucial feature is usually a graded death benefit for non-accidental death. This means if you die from illness or natural causes within the first 2 or sometimes 3 years of buying the policy, the beneficiaries typically only receive a return of the premiums paid, maybe plus some interest, not the full face amount. The full death benefit is usually only paid from day one for accidental death.
So it's really designed for people with no other options who want to cover at least final expenses eventually.
Exactly. It fills a specific niche for the otherwise uninsurable.
All right, let's switch context now and talk about group life insurance, the kind people often get through work. This is super common, right?
Extremely common. Group life is a cornerstone of employee benefits packages for millions of Americans. It provides coverage to a group of people, usually employees, under a single master contract held by the employer or organization.
What are the key advantages for employees?
A major one is accessibility. For the basic coverage amounts offered by the employer, often some multiple of salary like 1x or 2x, there's typically little or no individual medical underwriting required. You just have to be actively employed. This allows people who might have health issues to get some coverage easily.
And cost.
The cost for the basic coverage is often fully paid by the employer, or at least heavily subsidized. Even for additional voluntary coverage employees can buy, the group rates are often favorable compared to buying an individual policy on their own. Coverage amounts are usually determined by a formula like a multiple of salary, a flat amount, or based on job classification.
Are there different kinds of group insurance? Is it always term?
Mostly it's group term life. Provides pure death protection, usually renewed annually based on the group's overall demographics. No cash value accumulation. However, some plans might offer options for group permanent life insurance, like group universal life or group whole life, which can build cash value and potentially continue after you leave employment.
What happens if you leave your job? Do you just lose the coverage?
Not always. Many group policies offer options for portability or conversion when employment ends.
Portability, conversion, what's the difference?
Portability often allows you to continue the same group term coverage by paying the premiums directly yourself, though the rates might increase over time based on age bands. Conversion typically allows you to convert your group term coverage into an individual permanent policy, like whole life, offered by the same insurance carrier, without having to provide evidence of insurability, meaning no medical exam.
Conversion sounds good. Skipping the medical exam. Any downsides?
The main downside of conversion is usually cost. The premiums for the individual permanent policy will be based on your age at the time of conversion and are often significantly higher than what you were paying under the group term plan. So while it guarantees coverage, it might not be affordable for everyone.
Are there specific laws governing group life?
Yes. State insurance laws regulate policy provisions like mandatory conversion rights. And at the federal level, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA, sets standards for things like plan communication, summary plan descriptions, claims procedures, and the fiduciary duties of employers who sponsor the plans.
How does the claims process usually work?
It's typically straightforward. The beneficiary submits a claim form along with a certified death certificate. The employer verifies the deceased was covered under the plan. The benefit is usually paid out as a lump sum, although installment options might sometimes be available.
So even if the coverage amounts aren't always huge, group life seems incredibly important for providing a base level of protection.
Absolutely. For many families, the life insurance they get through work is the only life insurance they have. It's a critical safety net, especially for those who might be underinsured or find individual coverage unaffordable or hard to obtain. It plays a massive role in overall financial security.
Okay, let's pivot now to how businesses use life insurance. Key person insurance sounds important. What's the goal there?
Key person insurance, sometimes called key man insurance, is designed to protect a business from the financial fallout. If a crucial employee, someone whose death would significantly harm the company's operations or profitability, were to pass away unexpectedly.
So the business buys the policy?
Yes. The business applies for, owns, pays the premiums for, and is the beneficiary of the policy on the key employee's life.
What kind of financial harm are we talking about?
It could be loss of revenue directly generated by that person, delays or failure of critical projects they were leading, damage to important client relationships they managed, or simply the significant costs associated with finding, recruiting, and training a suitable replacement. The insurance proceeds provide funds to help the business weather that disruption.
How does a business decide who is a key person and how much coverage to get?
Identifying key persons involves looking beyond just titles. It's about their actual contribution. Do they drive significant revenue, possess unique, hard-to-replace skills or knowledge, have critical leadership roles, maintain vital relationships. It requires a systematic analysis.
Any amount.
Determining the coverage amount can be done a few ways. One method tries to capitalize the profits attributable to that key person. Another looks at the estimated costs to replace them, recruitment fees, training costs, lost productivity during the transition. Often it's a combination of factors.
How does this show up on the company's books?
If it's term insurance, the premiums are generally just treated as a business expense. If it's a permanent policy-building cash value, that cash value becomes an asset on the company's balance sheet.
And taxes.
Importantly, the premiums paid by the business for key person insurance are generally not tax-deductible. However, the death benefit received by the business is usually income tax-free. Though C corporations need to be mindful of potential alternative minimum tax implications.
Okay, makes sense. Another big business use, funding buy-sell agreements. What's the concept?
A buy-sell agreement is essentially a contract between business co-owners that dictates what happens to an owner's share of the business if they die, become disabled, retire, or otherwise leave the company. It provides an orderly transition of ownership.
And life insurance funds this?
Very often, yes, especially for the death trigger. Life insurance provides the immediate cash needed for the remaining owners, or the company itself, to buy out the deceased owner's share from their estate, ensuring the business can continue smoothly and the deceased owner's family receives fair value for their interest.
Are there different ways these agreements are structured?
Yes. Commonly you see entity purchase or stock redemption agreements where the company buys back the departing owner's shares, or cross-purchase agreements where the remaining owners individually buy the shares. There are also hybrid or wait-and-see agreements that provide flexibility.
How do they figure out the price, the value of the business?
That's a critical part of the agreement, defining the valuation methodology up front. It could be a fixed price agreed upon periodically, a formula based on earnings or revenue, a formal appraisal process, or a combination. Having a clear, objective valuation mechanism prevents disputes later.
Life insurance seems perfect for the death scenario. What about funding buyouts triggered by retirement or disability?
Right. Life insurance doesn't directly help there. The buy-sell agreement needs to specify other funding methods for those events. That might involve using company cash reserves, setting up installment payments over time, seller financing, or potentially using disability buyout insurance specifically designed for that purpose.
Seems particularly important for family businesses.
Absolutely. Buy-sell agreements are crucial for family businesses to ensure continuity and fairness, especially when some family members are active in the business and others aren't. Life insurance can provide liquidity to equalize inheritances and fund the transfer without crippling the business. Coordinating this requires careful planning involving legal, tax, and financial advisors.
Let's talk about using life insurance in executive compensation. How does that work?
Life insurance can be a very effective tool for companies looking to attract, retain, and reward key executives with supplemental benefits beyond standard salary and bonuses. These are typically non-qualified plans, meaning they can be selective, offered only to specific executives or highly compensated employees, unlike qualified plans like 401ks that have strict participation rules.
What kind of benefits are we talking about?
A common application is in funding non-qualified deferred compensation NQDC plans. Executives agree to defer a portion of their current income until a later date, usually retirement. The company often uses corporate-owned life insurance, or COLI, as a vehicle to informally fund its future obligation to pay out that deferred compensation.
So the company owns the policy on the executive?
Yes. The company owns the COLI policy, pays the premiums, and is the beneficiary. The tax-deferred growth of the cash value inside the COLI policy helps the company accumulate the funds needed to eventually pay the promised benefits to the executive. The death benefit can also provide cost recovery for the company if the executive dies before receiving all their deferred compensation.
Are there specific rules around these plans?
Yes, very specific rules. Section 409A of the Internal Revenue Code imposes strict requirements on how NQDC plans must be structured regarding deferral elections and distribution timing to avoid immediate taxation and penalties for the executive.
And for the COLI itself.
Section 101J of the tax code has important rules, too. It requires employers to provide notice to employees and obtain their consent before purchasing life insurance on them, and it dictates the tax treatment of the death benefits, generally ensuring they remain tax-free if the requirements are met. Compliance is crucial.
What are the key things companies need to think about when designing these plans?
Benefit security for the executive is often a concern, as the promise is just an unsecured obligation of the company. Sometimes techniques like rabbi trusts are used to provide some protection. Cost recovery for the corporation is another factor, and clear communication with the executives about how the plan works and its benefits and risks is essential. It definitely requires a team approach. Compensation consultants, insurance specialists, tax advisors, ERISA attorneys.
We've mentioned CLI a few times now, corporate-owned life insurance. And sometimes you hear BLI, bank-owned life insurance. Can you expand on their broader uses?
Sure. COI and BLI are essentially the same concept. An organization owning life insurance on its employees or members for business purposes. The primary goal is usually to leverage the tax-advantaged cash value accumulation and the tax-free death benefit as a long-term institutional asset.
So beyond funding executive benefits, what else?
Companies might use COLI to informally fund other long-term liabilities like post-retirement healthcare obligations for employees, or simply as a way to manage corporate assets efficiently from a tax perspective. Banks find BLI particularly attractive for several reasons.
Touch us.
It provides stable returns, often yielding more than other permissible high-quality investments banks can hold. It helps with asset liability management, and it generally receives favorable treatment under bank capital regulations. It's become a standard investment for many U.S. banks.
Are there special insurance products designed just for Calliope?
Yes. Insurance carriers offer institutional-grade products tailored for this market. They often feature lower commission structures, more flexible policy loan provisions designed for corporate use, and investment options suited to institutional needs, like general account, separate account, or hybrid designs.
Given the company owns policies on employees, any other regulatory or ethical traps besides 409A and 101J?
Absolutely. Besides the crucial notice and consent under 101J, there are considerations around employee privacy. Best practices emphasize having a clear, legitimate business purpose beyond just tax advantages. Limiting the insured population to appropriate groups, not just rank-and-file employees without a clear financial link, is important. And strong corporate governance and ongoing monitoring are key. For banks, regulators also provide guidance on concentration limits, how much BLI is prudent to hold relative to capital.
It sounds like Calliope has faced some controversy in the past.
It has. Decades ago, there were concerns about some companies buying COLI very broadly on lower-level employees, sometimes without clear communication, primarily for tax arbitrage. Modern programs, however, driven by regulations like 101J and increased scrutiny, tend to focus much more on legitimate business purposes, transparency, and ensuring economic substance. But careful implementation and ongoing management remain critical.
Okay, let's move to business succession planning. How does life insurance fit into the overall picture of passing a business on?
Business succession planning is the whole process of preparing for the transfer of leadership, management, and ownership of a business to the next generation or new owners. Life insurance is often a critical funding mechanism within that plan, especially for ownership transfer triggered by an owner's death. It guarantees the liquidity will be there exactly when it's needed.
What does the overall planning process involve beyond just the funding?
It's comprehensive. It starts with the current owner's objectives. What do they want for the business's future, their employees, their family, their own retirement? It involves identifying and developing potential successors, whether internal or external. It requires putting governance structures in place. And it takes time, often 5 to 10 years, to implement properly.
So it's not just about the money?
Not at all. There are three key dimensions: management succession, who will run the company; ownership succession, who will own the equity and how will it transfer; and estate planning integration, how does the business fit into the owner's personal wealth transfer goals and tax planning. Life insurance primarily addresses the funding for ownership transfer and potential estate tax needs, but the proceeds could also temporarily fund hiring interim management if needed.
Family businesses must have unique challenges here too.
Huge challenges. Choosing among siblings, dealing with family members not interested in the business, managing expectations about fairness, the founder's emotional difficulty letting go. It's complex. Life insurance can be invaluable here, providing funds to buy out exiting family owners or to equalize inheritances for non-business heirs, facilitating a smoother transition. Again, a team of advisors is usually essential.
We keep coming back to estate planning. Let's focus specifically on how life insurance serves that function.
Life insurance is a cornerstone of effective estate planning for many people, particularly those with larger estates or specific liquidity needs. Its primary role is often creating immediate tax-free cash exactly when it's needed most upon death.
Why is that cash needed?
To pay potential estate taxes, which can be substantial for larger estates, preventing the need to sell off other assets like a family business or real estate, possibly at fire sale prices. It can also cover final expenses, administrative costs, and outstanding debts.
What about other uses beyond just paying taxes?
It's used for wealth replacement. If you make significant charitable gifts in your will, life insurance can replace the value of those assets for your heirs. It's the funding vehicle for advanced strategies like irrevocable life insurance trusts.
ILEATs. What do they do?
By having the trust own the policy outside of your estate, the death benefit is generally not subject to estate taxes. ILEATs also provide asset protection and allow you to control how the proceeds are managed and distributed long after you're gone. Life insurance is also crucial for funding special needs trusts for dependents with disabilities, providing resources without disqualifying them from government benefits, and it helps equalize inheritances in blended families or family business situations.
Estate tax laws change, though. Is it still relevant with the current high exemptions?
Yes, for several reasons. First, the current high federal estate tax exemption is temporary. It's scheduled to be cut roughly in half in 2026 unless Congress acts. Second, many states have their own separate estate or inheritance taxes with much lower exemption amounts. And third, even without taxes, the liquidity life insurance provides for debts, expenses, and equalization is often still vital. Regular reviews are key.
Can life insurance also play a role in retirement planning, not just death benefit?
It can, yes, as a supplemental strategy for some people.
Uh-huh.
Certain types of permanent policies, especially those designed for cash accumulation and structured correctly as non-MSEs, modified endowment contracts, can build up significant cash value on a tax-deferred basis.
And you can access that cash in retirement.
Yes, often through tax-advantaged policy loans. This can provide a source of supplemental retirement income that doesn't necessarily count as taxable income, unlike withdrawals from 401ks or IRAs. It can offer longevity protection, as you can potentially access funds throughout retirement.
What about long-term care costs?
That's another application. Many hybrid life insurance policies now include riders that allow you to accelerate a portion of the death benefit, income tax-free, specifically to pay for qualifying long-term care expenses if needed.
So it can serve multiple purposes.
Yeah.
But is it a primary retirement tool?
Generally, no. Most financial planners would advise prioritizing contributions to dedicated retirement accounts like 401ks and IRAs first, building emergency savings, and paying down high-interest debt. Life insurance for retirement is usually considered after those foundations are in place. And the long-term nature means the financial strength of the insurance carrier is absolutely critical.
What about charitable giving? How can life insurance help there?
It's actually a very powerful, often overlooked charitable giving tool. Several ways to use it.
Like what?
The simplest is just naming a charity as the beneficiary or partial beneficiary of your policy. It's easy, flexible, though generally doesn't give you a current income tax deduction.
Okay. More complex ways.
You can make the charity the owner of the policy on your life. If you then make contributions to the charity to cover the premium payments, those contributions may be tax deductible for you. This allows you to leverage relatively small premium payments into a much larger future gift for the charity.
That sounds like a good way to make a bigger impact.
It can be. You can also donate an existing policy you no longer need to a charity. There are also more advanced strategies involving wealth replacement, using insurance to replace assets donated to charity, or even using life insurance within charitable remainder trusts in some cases. It requires careful planning with advisors familiar with these techniques.
And college funding. Can life insurance fit in there?
It can play a couple of roles. First, the death benefit provides protection, ensuring funds are available for college even if a parent dies prematurely. Second, the cash value in a permanent policy grows tax deferred.
Any other advantages for college savings?
One potential advantage is how cash value is treated in federal financial aid calculations. Currently, the cash value of life insurance owned by parents is generally not counted as an asset on the HAFSA Save Form, free application for federal student aid.
Unlike savings in a 529 plan.
Exactly. Assets in 529 plans and regular savings investment accounts are counted and can reduce eligibility for need-based aid. So for families potentially on the borderline for aid, holding some savings within a life insurance policy might be advantageous from a financial aid perspective. However, the primary purpose should still align with insurance needs, and it's usually just one piece of a broader college funding strategy.
Finally, let's talk legacy planning. How does life insurance help shape the legacy you leave behind?
Life insurance is inherently a legacy tool because its core function is providing a benefit after you're gone. It allows you to potentially leave a larger financial legacy than might otherwise be possible, as the death benefit often significantly exceeds the total premiums paid.
We mentioned ILITs and dynasty trusts for estate planning. They fit here too.
Absolutely. ILITs ensure the legacy passes free of estate taxes and with creditor protection, according to your wishes. Dynasty trusts use life insurance, often combined with leveraging the generation-skipping transfer, GST tax exemption, to create a legacy designed to last for multiple generations, providing benefits while minimizing transfer taxes along the way.
What about specific family situations?
It's crucial for special needs planning, ensuring lifelong support for a dependent with disabilities through a properly structured trust funded with life insurance. It's also invaluable in blended families for clearly defining and providing for obligations to current spouses, children from prior relationships, and ensuring fairness. And as we've discussed, it's key in funding business transfers as part of a legacy plan.
When planning for legacy using permanent insurance, what's a key consideration?
Premium sustainability. Because these plans often rely on coverage lasting potentially for decades, it's critical to have a realistic plan for paying the premiums long term, ensuring the legacy goal isn't jeopardized by the policy lapsing unexpectedly.
Wow. So summarizing all these applications, life insurance really is incredibly versatile, isn't it? It touches on protection, savings, retirement, estate planning, business needs, charity, legacy.
It truly is. When understood and applied correctly, it's a unique financial tool that offers guarantees and solutions that are hard to replicate elsewhere. It transforms uncertainty, the what if of premature death, into a predetermined financial outcome. But that applied correctly part is key.
Which brings us right to product suitability. How do you make sure the specific policy fits the person's actual needs? Where does that process start?
It absolutely has to start with a thorough needs analysis. You can't recommend a solution until you deeply understand the problem, or in this case, the need.
What does that involve?
It means gathering detailed information about the person's family situation, their income, assets, debts, their short-term and long-term financial goals, their existing resources, their tolerance for risk. It's a fact-finding mission.
Are there standard ways to do this analysis?
Yes. Financial professionals use various methods. The human life value approach tries to calculate the economic value of the individual's future earnings. A needs analysis, or capital needs analysis, focuses on calculating the specific amount of capital needed to meet future obligations, like paying off the mortgage, funding college, providing income for survivors, if the person were to die today. Technology helps a lot now with software tools to model these scenarios.
The goal is to figure out the right amount of coverage.
Exactly. How much money would be needed to fulfill the financial obligations and goals that would be left unmet?
Okay, once you know the amount, how do you choose the right type of policy? Term, whole life, UL, VUL, IUL.
That's where suitability factors come in. You layer the individual's circumstances onto the needs analysis. How old are they? What's their health status? What's their budget for premiums? Critically, how long do they need the coverage for? Is it a temporary need, like until the kids are grown, or a permanent need, like estate taxes?
Wow.
Their overall financial situation, their investment risk tolerance, especially relevant for variable or indexed products, what other insurance or assets they already have, specific family circumstances, like special needs dependents, and of course, their likely underwriting classification based on health and lifestyle. All these pieces have to be considered together.
It sounds like the right answer changes dramatically depending on someone's life stage.
Absolutely. A young single person might only need enough to cover debts and final expenses, maybe through group insurance. A young family with a mortgage and kids likely needs a significant amount of affordable term insurance. Someone mid-career might start layering in permanent insurance for longer-term goals. Empty nesters might reduce coverage or focus on estate planning or long-term care. Retirees might use insurance for legacy or final expenses. Needs evolve.
We talked about underwriting. What if someone does have health issues? Does that automatically rule out certain types of insurance?
Not necessarily. Different insurers specialize in underwriting different risks. Some are more favorable for, say, diabetics, while others might be better for people with heart conditions. An experienced independent agent can often help navigate this. If standard underwriting isn't possible, simplified issue or guaranteed issue policies might be options, accepting the trade-offs of higher cost and lower face amounts. And group insurance often remains available.
Policy replacements, switching policies. This seems like an area where suitability is really critical and maybe tricky.
extremely critical. Replacing an existing policy needs intense scrutiny. Is there a genuine, tangible benefit to the client? Or is it being driven by the agent's commission on a new sale?
What are legitimate reasons to consider a replacement?
Maybe the new policy offers significantly lower premiums for the same or better coverage due to improved health or market changes. Perhaps it offers important new features or riders the old one lacks. Maybe consolidating multiple older, smaller policies makes sense. But you have to weigh that against potential downsides.
Wait.
Losing valuable guarantees or features of the old policy. Facing new surrender charge periods. Resetting the 2-year contestability and suicide clauses. Potentially higher premiums if health has worsened. Tax implications. It requires a very detailed, objective comparison, clearly documenting why the replacement benefits the client. Regulators monitor this area closely.
What about life settlements? Selling your policy. When does that make sense?
A life settlement is selling an existing policy you no longer need or want to a third-party investor company for a lump sum. This sum is more than the cash surrender value, but less than the death benefit.
Who might consider this?
Typically, seniors who find premiums unaffordable, whose original need for the coverage has passed, kids grown, estate plan changed, or sometimes those with a shortened life expectancy due to illness who need funds now.
Are there downsides?
Yes. The proceeds are generally taxable, part ordinary income, part capital gain. It involves sharing personal health information, and it's crucial to explore alternatives first, like accelerated death benefits, policy loans, or reducing the coverage to lower premiums before selling a policy. It's a complex transaction needing careful advice.
Okay, we've talked a lot about the benefits of life insurance, but what are some of the valid criticisms, particularly of permanent insurance?
Fair question. One major criticism is cost, especially the internal costs and fees in permanent policies, commissions, mortality charges, administrative fees, surrender penalties if you cancel early. These can significantly reduce the net returns compared to other investments. Complexity is another. Policies like VUL or IUL can be very hard for consumers to fully understand, especially the non-guaranteed elements and how illustrations work. Policy lapse rates are also a concern. Many permanent policies are surrendered in the early years, meaning consumers pay high initial costs but don't get the long-term benefits. And historically, the investment returns within some types of cash value policies have lagged behind returns available in the broader market, though direct comparisons are tricky due to the insurance component and tax treatment.
So how does that classic buy term and invest the difference argument hold up against permanent insurance?
It's a theoretical debate with points on both sides. Mathematically, if someone is disciplined enough to consistently invest the premium savings from buying term instead of permanent and achieves good market returns, they might end up with more wealth over the long run.
But the if is the key word there.
Exactly. Behavioral finance tells us many people don't have that discipline. The forced savings aspect of permanent insurance can be beneficial for some. Plus, permanent insurance offers the unique death benefit guarantee, potential creditor protection, and tax advantages on cash value growth and loans that aren't replicated by just investing. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison. The better approach depends entirely on the individual circumstances, discipline, and goals.
What concerns do consumer advocates often raise about the industry?
Compensation structures are a big one. The potential for commission-driven sales to create conflicts of interest, leading to recommendations that benefit the agent more than the client. Illustration practices are another concern that illustrations, especially for complex products, can sometimes project unrealistic, non-guaranteed returns, creating false expectations. Lack of ongoing service after the sale is sometimes criticized too.
How is the industry responding to these concerns?
We're seeing evolution. Product innovation is aiming for more transparency and flexibility. Needs analysis tools are becoming more sophisticated. There's experimentation with different compensation models like fee-based advice or levelized commissions that pay out more evenly over time, reducing the incentive for inappropriate replacements. And the push towards higher fiduciary or best interest standards is also a major factor.
So for someone seeking advice, what does a balanced, suitable recommendation process look like?
It starts with that thorough needs analysis, understanding the why and how much. It involves a realistic assessment of how long the need exists. It honestly evaluates the client's financial capacity to sustain the premiums. It considers their risk tolerance and unique circumstances. It transparently discusses the pros and cons of different options, including costs and guarantees versus non-guarantees. And it includes a plan for regular reviews.
The source document has some case studies. Can you give an example of clearly unsuitable advice?
Sure. Imagine recommending a large, expensive whole life policy to that young family we talked about. the one with a tight budget but huge income replacement need if a parent dies. Even though whole life has guarantees, if the high premium means they can only afford a $100,000 policy when they really need $1 million of coverage, that's unsuitable. It leaves them drastically underinsured during their most vulnerable years. Prioritizing adequate term coverage would be far more suitable in that case.
Or the opposite.
Recommending a complex, high-risk VUL policy focused on aggressive market growth to an elderly person on a fixed income whose primary goal is preserving capital and covering final expenses. That's a massive mismatch of risk tolerance and objectives. Something much safer and simpler would be appropriate. Suitability is all about the right product for the right person for the right reason.
That really clarifies it. This leads perfectly into our final crucial section, ethics. Given the stakes involved, ethical practice seems non-negotiable.
It absolutely has to be the foundation. We're dealing with people's long-term financial security, promises made sometimes decades into the future, and significant sums of money often triggered by emotional events like death. Trust is paramount, and that requires unwavering ethical conduct.
What does acting ethically mean in this context? Is it just following the rules?
Following the rules, the laws and regulations is the bare minimum. Ethical practice goes beyond that. It means consistently acting in the client's best interest, even when it might conflict with your own potential compensation or convenience. It means prioritizing their needs above all else.
And full disclosure is a big part of that.
Huge. Ethics demands complete transparency, fully explaining the policy features, benefits, risks, costs, limitations, and especially the non-guaranteed elements. It's not just handing over a confusing illustration. It's ensuring the client substantively understands what they are buying and why it's suitable for them. Documenting that process is also key.
You contrasted needs-based selling with product-driven selling. Why is that an ethical distinction?
Because needs-based selling starts with the client. What do they need? Then you find the appropriate solution. Product-driven selling starts with the product the agent wants to sell and then tries to fit the client into it, whether it's truly the best fit or not. Ethically, only the needs-based approach is justifiable. If an advisor seems to recommend the same product to almost everyone, that might be a red flag for a product-driven approach.
Policy replacements seem like an ethical minefield.
They can be, precisely because of the conflict of interest the agent gets paid again on the new policy. Ethical handling of replacements requires extreme diligence. Is this truly demonstrably better for the client? Have all the pros and cons been weighed and clearly explained? Is the rationale documented? Avoiding churning, replacing policies just to generate commissions, is a fundamental ethical obligation. Systems should be in place to monitor replacement activity.
We mentioned conflicts of interest around compensation. How else can this manifest?
Beyond just favoring higher commission products, it could involve recommending higher premium amounts than necessary, favoring certain carriers based on incentive trips or bonuses rather than policyholder value. While commission is a valid way to be paid, ethical advisors manage these potential conflicts by always putting the client's interests first. Transparency about compensation can also help. Fee-based advice models attempt to remove this conflict altogether, though they have their own considerations.
What about serving vulnerable consumers, seniors, people with limited financial literacy?
This demands an even higher ethical standard. It requires taking extra care to communicate clearly and simply, ensuring comprehension, being vigilant for signs of diminished capacity or undue influence from others, and patiently answering all questions. It means protecting them from potentially unsuitable or exploitative sales practices. It's about empowerment and protection, not just making a sale.
Even the language used can be an ethical issue.
Definitely. Using terms like permanent, without explaining limitations, or guaranteed issue, without clarifying the graded death benefit, or historically vanishing premium illustrations that proved unrealistic. These can be technically accurate, but functionally misleading. Ethical communication strives for genuine understanding, not just technical correctness. Honesty and clarity are paramount.
What about privacy and data security in this digital age?
That's a massive ethical and legal responsibility now. Protecting clients' sensitive personal and financial information is critical. This involves complying with regulations like GLBA and state privacy laws, but ethically it means minimizing data collection, using it only for legitimate purposes, safeguarding it rigorously, and being transparent about data practices. Even things like using social media for underwriting have ethical dimensions regarding relevance and disclosure.
And ongoing education, how does that tie into ethics?
It's fundamental. Ethics requires competence. professionals have an obligation to maintain and enhance their knowledge and skills through continuing education, not just to meet licensing requirements, but to ensure they are providing competent, up-to-date advice. Pursuing advanced professional designations like CLU, CHFC, CFP often involves rigorous ethics training and adherence to a code of conduct. It's about professionalism and lifelong learning in service of the client.
Wow. Okay, this has been an incredibly thorough deep dive. We've covered so much ground from the history of life insurance through all the different policy types, the countless ways it's used in financial planning,
the importance of suitability analysis, and critically, the ethical foundation that must underpin the entire practice.
It really highlights life insurance as this unique tool offering risk transfer, tax advantages, guarantees when it's properly understood and implemented with integrity.
Absolutely. It's complex, no doubt about it, but incredibly valuable when used correctly.
And we really hope this discussion has helped you, our listener, get a clearer picture. We encourage you to take these insights and think about your own situation, your own needs, and how life insurance might fit into your financial security plan.
Yeah, maybe take a moment after this. What are those big financial what-ifs in your life? What keeps you up at night regarding long-term security for you and your loved ones? And could life insurance potentially be part of the solution?
That's a great question to ponder. And perhaps think about one thing you heard today that surprised you or shifted your perspective on life insurance. Thanks so much for joining us on the Deep Dive.